Good morning. Welcome to Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thanks for tuning in. And you're also invited to call in or send an email if you would like. If you have a question or comment during the course of the next 55 minutes or so, 414-1234, the local number in Tallahassee. It's 800-926-8809 if it's long distance from you to us, and it's perspectives at WFSU.org if you would like to tender an email comment. As we said right before Ron's news, what most parents, I think, probably dread more than anything else is just the prospect of a child preceding them in death. We count on the fact that our kids are going to outlive us. And when that does not occur, and it occurs because of a violent situation, it is just beyond comprehension, I think, to most of us who are parents. And when someone who has undergone that situation then makes something positive out of it, makes an effort to turn things around, not just for themselves but also for the community and the person who actually has wronged them, that is something that I think is also beyond the comprehension of most of us. So I thought on the advice of some folks here in the community, not the least of which being Tallahassee City Commissioner Gil Ziffer and some other folks who had suggested that we bring on some very special local folks who have undergone what, again, most of us would find absolutely inconceivable. We welcome the Gromaire family, Kate and Andy, to these microphones. Kate, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, and Andy, good to have you, too.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
We want to get to your story here in just a second, along with Agnes Fury, who also joins us here today. And Agnes, it's wonderful to have you.
Good morning, and thanks for having us here.
Okay, well, let's talk. Agnes, as long as we're with you, tell us your story. What happened to you and your family?
My daughter and my grandson were murdered in 1998. They were murdered by somebody that she knew. I got a phone call telling me that they were both dead.
Did the call come from the police or family or what?
No, actually, I had been trying to reach her and I couldn't reach her. And when I couldn't reach her, I had called the law enforcement agencies where she lived. And I was at work and I kept calling my home to see if I had any messages. And I got a message on my home phone that there was an officer at my door, and would I please wake up and talk with the officer? Now, I wasn't there, so I called the dispatcher, and they had two officers come to where I was working, and they had a card with a number for me to call. So I called the number, and it was a lieutenant who asked to speak to the officer, and the officer took the phone, and all I had to do was look at his face and know that whatever it was not good. And then he handed me the phone, and the officer on the other end of the phone told me that they were both dead and that they'd been murdered.
How old was your daughter and her son?
She was 40 and he was 6.
What happened with the person who perpetrated the crime?
He was convicted of 2 counts of first degree murder.
And then imprisoned?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. What happened then?
He's serving 2 life sentences. Somehow in those very first hours and days after I'd learned that they were murdered, I remember talking to a friend of mine and saying, someday I'm going to talk with this man. And at that time, it wasn't that I was thinking in terms of conversation. It was, I'm going to talk with this man. Then over the next year, I became acquainted with some people at the Neighborhood Justice Center and learned about a concept that was called at that time, they called it BARGE, Balanced and Restorative Justice. And it was a program out of Florida Atlantic University that coordinated meetings and conversations around the country for people that were engaged in restorative justice practices. And I had an opportunity to participate in that program and went various places around the country and met with people and learned what they were doing and met people who had experienced restorative justice processes themselves. I met a man named Howard Zaire, who's with Eastern Mennonite University in Pennsylvania. And I don't remember exactly where I met him, whether it was a meeting in Chicago or Colorado or San Antonio. But I remember sitting around a table with him, and he impacted me greatly. He's written several books and studies around restorative justice. He's written a book called The Little Book of Restorative Justice. And he has another book that the victim advocate that responded to me that first night when I was notified gave me a couple of years later. It's a picture book of people that are serving life sentences in Pennsylvania and a little bit about their stories and a little bit about what they're doing now while they're in prison. And it's the title is something like living life while doing life. And that really impacted me, that these are real people. Let me go back up a little bit. The man who killed my daughter, his name is Leonard. And when Leonard's grandmother was notified what happened, I was sitting in the detective's office, and she had just hung up from notifying his family that he was in jail and charged with murder. And while she was on the phone with the grandmother had a heart attack. And somebody took the phone and said, I have to hang up. I have to call 911. And the detective was shook. She'd been in law enforcement for years. She said she never had anybody fall out with a heart attack while she was on the phone with them. And that was, you know, that made it really real to me that, you know, he was connected to a family.
He was not just the anonymous person
who
comes in, does a horrible thing. I want to talk about how you got into the process and what it's done, not just for Leonard, but also for you, Agnes. A few minutes to go before the break, but Kate, just tell us about the situation you and Andy went through, your story.
Well, we had been out working in the yard that day, and like you say, the worst thing you ever expect is to hear the doorbell ring and see a deputy sheriff on the other side of the door.
This was when?
This was in March of 2010. It was March 28th. And she told us, the deputy sheriff told us that Anna had been shot and that she was there to take us to the hospital. Now, she was with Connor McBride, her fiance, and so we asked about him. We said, you know, how is Connor? Where is Connor? And that's when she said, Connor is the one who shot Ann. She seemed a little reluctant to tell us that. And it just seemed so unreal. I mean, you're listening to the words. I think at the time I thought you know, it must have been some minor little injury, some accident. And we went upstairs to get ready to go to the hospital, and we stood in the room, and we held hands, and we said a prayer for Ann, and then we said a prayer for Connor, because we just knew that wherever he was and whatever he had gone through, he needed prayers as well. So we went to the hospital, and pretty quickly it was clear that her injuries were pretty grave. And in just a few days, again, it was clear that she would not survive her injuries. So we took her off life support on Friday, which was Good Friday that particular year, April 2nd.
And Connor was arrested and then went through the judicial process and convicted?
Well, he had actually turned himself in. He drove to the Tallahassee Police Department and turned himself in, told them that he had shot his fiancée. And because the crime occurred in Leon County, he was actually arrested by the sheriff's office and taken to jail.
And when was he then convicted? And was this a first-degree murder, or what was the?
The initial charge was second-degree murder, but then after it went to the grand jury, it was first-degree murder. He never went to trial. We decided – well, we weren't sure – we didn't know much about the process at all, not being lawyers. And so we were hoping that we could do the best for Connor, considering – that what we did know was with 1020 life, the gun law, that he was most likely going to receive life in prison. So our intention was to try and get him into possibly a faith-based prison. And in the course of that, Allison DeFour, who is the chaplain at Wakulla Prison, said you should really look at restorative justice because I think that's really what you want. And Andy researched that, and we looked at it and we said – yes, I think this is something that we would want to do, which is, you know, having the offender and the victims and representatives from the community all sit in a room face to face, and the victims talk about what the loss meant to them. And for us, it was the loss of our daughter. And then the offender is willing to take responsibility for their actions. And so after our conference, which was a pre-plea conference, the state attorney offered 20 years with 10 years of probation, and that's what was ultimately accepted.
Restorative justice, our topic on Perspectives this morning. 414-1234, 800-926-8809. Imagining the unimaginable and the death of a child at the hands of a violent situation and then making peace with the person who actually committed the offense, a concept called restorative justice. We have the Gramaire family with us today, Kate and Andy, and we also have Agnes Fury. They all lost family members because of violence. Andy, in your case, even you knew Connor. What kind of relationship did you have with him prior to the killing?
Well, like any good relationship you have with your daughter's boyfriend, he was in fear of me, and so that's the you know. But it was respectful. I mean, you know, he would help me sometimes with some of the chores around the house and things like that. And you know, we certainly would talk. You know, when he came, you know, to pick up my daughter, they would come over to eat dinner, things like that. But we actually had known Connor for like 2 or 3 years before this all happened.
Okay, and having that sort of relationship, and then to have this happen, it's different than again the unknown person who suddenly crashes into your life, does something horrible, and you don't know who this person. You knew this guy.
Yes, it was very surprising, and just something you can't imagine. I mean, you just can't imagine it happening. I mean, I think there was a lot of shock and awe when we first heard about it. And, you know, I always thought maybe it was an accident or something when I first heard about it until we found out more information about it.
You said – Kate had mentioned that everyone sits down in a room. I mean, did he say, I'm sorry?
Yes. He was very apologetic, very sorry for what he had done and asked for us, you know, just kept saying over and over again that he was sorry.
Okay. And what's the situation with Connor right now?
Right now he's serving his sentence in Liberty Correctional Institution. We're allowed to go out and visit him on a regular basis. We go about once a month to go to see him and sit down and talk with him and just encourage him in his journey to find his place where he can be. I think difficult to process or assess what he's done and really get to why he's done such a things, and you know, encourage him to take classes on anger management and to help him in his faith walk too.
Mm-hmm. Has he forgiven himself, do you think?
I don't know that. I think that's probably one of the most difficult things that he probably has to do.
Okay. Agnes Fury, let me ask you, what's your relationship with the young man who killed your daughter and her boy?
Well, we've been corresponding for now about 7 years, 6-7 years. I have not yet visited him. I did meet him about 2 years before the crime happened, but I can't say I knew him. I'd met him.
It was just an acquaintance of your daughter then?
Mm-hmm.
And his name is Leonard. What does he say in the correspondence to you?
Well, he has never denied what he did. From the very beginning, I had the opportunity to read the transcripts of his initial questioning, and he'd never denied it. He, I believe, still has not forgiven himself. He still lives with that. One of the things that in our early correspondence, he said, "What can I do?" And, well, you can't fix it. But what you can do is make a difference where you are. You know, I believe in community. I believe we're all part of a community. And we affect each other whether we intend to or not whenever we have an interaction with somebody. And they affect us. And we may not intend, but we do affect each other. And even in prison, they're living in a community, and they affect each other. And he's not coming out, but most of the men that he lives with will be coming out. About 90% of the people that we put in prison do come back to live with us. And if he can make a positive impact on some of those folks that are coming back to live with us, then maybe that can make a difference for our community.
Before all this came to be here on this particular program, a number of folks just articulated one simple question, and that is, how can anyone who has undergone this type of situation find it in their own hearts to forgive? The normal, the instinctive reaction for all of us is anger and vengeance and vindictiveness and the utter grief that you – and loss and all of these things. How can you – do you get over that? Do you put it in a box and just put it aside, Agnes? What do you do with these things?
You go through it. That's all I can say is that we don't choose the road we're given, but we choose how we're going to walk on it. And if anything can honor my daughter in her attempt to help a troubled person that she lost her life, then anything that I can do that may make it better for somebody else that's impacted by somebody else's actions, then for me, that's worth doing.
Okay. And I guess Kate and Andy, same question for you. I mean, this was Anne. This was the light of your life. She's gone. How do you deal with that?
I think Andy and I both believe that our entire lives brought us to that moment and brought us through that moment. We're both faith-based people. We're both Catholics. Jesus said to Peter, "You must forgive 70 times 7. And I tell people that's because we need the practice. And so both of us had worked in the healing ministries at our church and had prayed with people about forgiveness, you know, forgiveness of family members, of course, never anything like this. And so we had a background where we saw the benefits of forgiveness and what it meant to people. And I tell people I practiced forgiveness a lot on my husband. And, you know, we saw how forgiving one another in our marriage helped our marriage. So there was for me a knowledge, you know, there was never a moment where until I said I forgave Connor that I consciously said, oh, this is forgiveness. But it was just my thoughts that I had that week. We had a meeting with Michael and Julie. They came to the hospital every night to visit Anne. And one night I said to them, I said, we cannot define Connor by this one moment in his life, because if we define Connor by that one moment, then we're defining Anne by that one moment. And she becomes merely a murder victim. And she was so much more than that. And I think by forgiving Connor, you know, releasing him from that debt, it allows us to move past that moment and to celebrate Anne's life, her whole life. You know, she died a certain way, but there was so much more of her life that she lived. And a lot of people think, you know, forgiveness, Connor many times said, thank you so much for forgiving me. Forgiveness is for the person who forgives. It really releases you from any expectation. Connor cannot bring Anne back to us. He owes us her life. And for us to expect him to be able to repay that will just leave us in this place of always wanting. So by forgiving him that debt, by saying Connor does not owe us Anne's life, we can move beyond that. And I think, you know, revenge, it never was there. I do sometimes think when things, you know, the holidays, we just went by the holidays and, you know, we hang her stocking and, you know, there wasn't anything in it. And you just sometimes I'll look at it and I'll think, you know, Connor, that stocking is empty because of you. But I can move past that. I don't have to stay in that moment and anguish over that empty stocking. It's sad and we feel sad about that, but we don't have to stay there. It doesn't lock us into that grief.
I was wondering because you know, some other folks who also are, you know, very faith-based and devout and in their belief go another way. It's, you know, I guess the Old Testament approach, the eye for the eye. You know, you took my daughter and you owe us your life because you took hers. And Andy, I don't hear that from you and Kate.
No, not at all. I feel like if I still had that anger and hatred toward him, I would be like I was locked up in prison with Connor. And I don't want to live in prison. I want to live my life for my wife and my family and for my community, so I can be there for them. Because I can't be, as Kate says, we cannot be caught up in that one moment. And I want to remember Anne for the life that she lived, the animal lover, the people, you know, that she cared about and things like that. And we also have two other daughters that if we just dwelt on this, how could we be a mother and father to them too?
Good point. Mm-hmm. Agnes Ferry, talk a little bit about your involvement with restorative justice. You said that it's not just a passive thing on your part. You're very actively involved in that. How?
As I said, we're still corresponding. And he, when I said, make a difference where you are, he took that very seriously. And I had sent him some materials, and he took some of those materials and some of Dr. Zera's books and wrote a curriculum for other inmates for them to become more involved in their own accountability for the harm that they caused. Because as humans, we have a large capability for denial. And particularly young people that commit crimes are very, very able to distance themselves from the consequences of that. And by doing peer groups, in prison, they can become better able to acknowledge the harm that was done by whatever it was that they did. And then getting to the point where they can choose to make their life different from there on. You know, recidivism is very, very high. And anything that we can do to reduce that, I think, is worth doing. You know, my journey has been a little bit different. I have more of an undefined relationship with a higher power. But something that I learned some years ago conversation was something was Micah 6:8, which has stuck with me for years. What does the Lord require but to do justice, to love mercy, and walk humbly with your Lord? And that was the one that defined my early journey. I've also worked in the field of addiction treatment for many years. So I come from that perspective that I'm well aware that people can be transformed, that it's possible. I've treated people over the years from any profession you can think of. And I've known people who have lived on the street that are today movers and shakers in our communities, that it happens, it can happen. And I'm a nurse, and I learned years ago something we refer to as person-first language, that if you're working in a hospital, you're not assigned to the gallbladder in room 312. You're treating Mrs. Murphy, who had her gallbladder out. So we try to think in terms of the person. And Leonard committed a murder. That's what he did. It's not necessarily who he is. And that wasn't very, very difficult for me to come to that realization. As Kate said, I never, even though I said I will someday I'm going to talk with this man, I never had an impulse to kill him. The state initially filed for the death penalty. And for the next year, I did not object to that. But when they were discussing that in 3 days he's going to plead if we take the death penalty off the table, my initial reaction was relief that we didn't have to go down that road.
Would you have pled for even more leniency were it possible?
I don't know. I can't go back and say what I would have done if. There was never a discussion that there was any options besides the death penalty or life without parole.
Okay. Kate, in your case, you and Andy did some intervention as far as Connor's situation at the state attorney's office, didn't you?
Yes. We, again, thought that because of the gun law that he would be sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. But when we talked to the state attorney, we found out that, especially before trial, in a plea situation, that there was a lot of leniency. And, you know, the idea we talked before that Connor owed us a life, and we thought, you know, if he has to spend time, you know, returning, if he has a sentence of 25 years, why can't half of that be spent in prison and half of that be spent returning something to the community to repair? In our situation, I mean, he couldn't fully repair it, but to repair in whatever way he could the harm that he had done. We had several nonprofit organizations who had agreed that he could work for them as part of, you know, if he were given probation, that they would allow him to do community service to, for that organization. And that was our hope, not to give him a lesser sentence or be lenient in any way, but what is the point of having him merely sit in a jail cell every day for 25 years? Wouldn't it be better if we could have him out here in the community working for whoever would want him to work, but especially for those things that Anne held dear?
Okay. So again, to complete that circle where not only are you folks as the victims, if you will, attempting to make something good of this, but also holding accountable the person who did you and your family wrong, bringing them into that effort to also make things better somehow.
Right. And that's the great thing about the conference that we have, because you actually get to sit across the table from the person who has hurt you and tell them how they've hurt you. And you don't normally get to do that in most criminal situations, court situations. Everybody's told to be quiet and silent and not reveal anything because it may either harm his case or your case or whatever. And so it was, there was a really freeing moment. And then also the opportunity to find out what happened. I mean, one thing that you don't know is what happened to my daughter. And Connor was able to tell us what happened. It was very hard to hear, but it was – at the end, it was very – there was a sense of peace that I had no more questions. You know, I knew what had happened.
Restorative justice is what we're talking about on Perspectives today. 414-1234-800-926-8809 and perspectives@wfsu.org is the email address. We'll be right back. Back on Perspectives, Restorative Justice, and we have the Gramaire family, Kate and Andy, and we also have Agnes Fury with us. By the way, our Twitter connection is at WFSU Perspective, and that is a singular perspective, even though the name of the show is Perspectives. Don't know how that happens, but it's Twitter. What can I tell you? An awful lot of media attention on this. And Agnes, you know, your story has been the focus of numerous media expostulations here, hasn't it? Does that surprise you?
Well, yes and no. I think it's something that is important. And one of the things we haven't mentioned is that I've published a book recently that Leonard and I both worked on for the past 2 years. We thought it might be important to share with other people the healing experience that we've had so that folks can see and understand that it is possible to heal from some of these terrible things. We thought about writing a book, and thinking about writing a book is almost an overwhelming concept. But we thought a little bit that I write poetry and I write prose and I have for some time, and he writes as well. And we thought, well, between my writing and his writing and several of his letters, we had enough to put a book together. So we gathered that all of those things up and put a book together.
Well, what's the name of it, and how can we find it?
The name of the book is Wildflowers in the Median, and it's on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com, and locally it's available at My Favorite Books in Market Square, St. John's Bookstore, and Sweet Patina on Thomasville Road.
Okay, I'm making notes here of all that, okay, so folks can find that. That must be a difficult collaboration, though. I mean, when people are even bi-coastal and you have authors that work together, mm-hmm, on something, but here, you know, you're on the outside, Leonard's on the inside, and yet you're writing a book together.
Yeah. His writing, I've typed some of his writing. I personally write with my right hand. It's a kinetic experience. I can't write on a computer. It's just not part of my DNA. And he would write something, and I would type it, and then I would send it to him. You can send 15 typed pages at a time. And he would edit it and send it back. And somehow we got it done. It's another learning experience.
And a great textbook. I can't wait to read it myself. Kate and Andy, in your case, I mean, gosh, New York Times Magazine, an appearance on the Today Show. I mean, this is you've gone national, perhaps even international, with your tale.
Yes, the woman who facilitated our circle, Sujatha Balaga, is a well-known expert in restorative justice, and so the writer of the New York Times article, Paul Tullis, approached her about doing a story, and she actually referred him to our story. So we thought that we wanted to make that impact. You know, whatever God's plans were for Anne in her life, that was changed the day that she died. And so now it's like, what can we do, as Agnes said, to honor our child? And so if we can help other people forgive because it's freeing for them, if we can help other communities begin a restorative justice process so that communities can heal, then that becomes Anne's legacy now.
Yeah. How much of a facilitation is the local situation of Palmer Monroe? How does that interface with folks who might be going through similar circumstances and getting them maybe headed in a different direction than they otherwise might? Andy? Or Kate?
Well, there's very few similar circumstances to ours because very few people pursue anything before sentencing. Usually it's after sentencing, before the release of a prisoner, that sometimes something will be facilitated. But with regards to Palmer Monroe, a lot of restorative justice across the country now is in teen diversion programs where they reach out to first offenders for minor crimes like even possibly stealing a car, shoplifting, those types of crimes. And they facilitate circles where the community comes in and the offender comes in and the teen has to be, you know, willing to accept responsibility for their actions. And then a lot of times they try to do their best to restore, you know, what the damage that was done, you know, paint the fence that they damaged or repair the bike or, you know, make right what was wrong. And a lot of times they write apology letters. Whoever they harmed is there to, you know, again, talk to them. And when you put a face, you know, when these teens can see the person that they've harmed, then there's that connection. And it really is harder the next time for them to commit a crime when they have that personal connection. They know. And they've also taken responsibility. That's such an important part of it, you know, to be willing to accept the responsibility. So programs like Palmer Monroe are so important. And it is the way that restorative justice is probably moving in the greatest way across the country. One of the things that we've done is we've established a fund under the Community Foundation of North Florida, the Ann Gromaire Be the Change Fund. And we've established that so that people can donate and we can help communities establish these types of restorative justice programs. We can help train facilitators for these types of programs and also possibly help pay for people to come into communities and explain the process to them.
Okay, big picture, Andy. Should this, through the Ann Gromaire Be the Change Fund and similar kinds of situations, that more of these sorts of mechanisms spring up so that people who are in similar or not even as bad circumstances as what you folks encountered have an opportunity to start the healing process, the forgiveness, all these things we've been talking about. What kind of vision do you have? How could that transform or change things, do you think, for the better nationally or nationally?
Well, I think it worked very well for us. It may not work for everybody, or everybody may not desire that. But I think the option should be there, that if someone wants to ability to sit down in front of the person that hurt them to tell them how they hurt. And also, like Kate said, so the offenders have a chance to see that it's not just this nameless person that they're harming. It's this person. It's this grandmother. It's this mother. It's this father, brother, whoever it might be. And that way they do have a sense of understanding of what it means of what they're doing. And it's just not taking something from a nameless person. And then you have a judge who hands down a sentence that they've never met. You know, the restorative justice actually allows people to work out sentencing within that circle, you know, as long as the community agrees. And once the offender takes responsibility and says, I agree with what y'all are saying, and I agree to fulfill my commitment to what y'all are saying, then they're much more willing to do it instead of some third party saying, you're going to do this. But if you say, I'm willing to do that, you're much more likely to do it. And it's a really great plus. Like if you deface the side of my building and I say, you know, that's my livelihood. You know, it passed down from my parents, my grandparents, and, you know, that's how I do. And so let's say at the end we say, I want you to repaint my side of the building. Well, if the judge says you're going to paint that building, yeah, okay, you may have to do it because the judge is telling you. But if you sit there and say, I agree to do it, you're much more willing to do it, and you're probably going to do a much better job about it because it has meaning and you've agreed to do it. So it really does help that.
And you get to see the consequence of your actions all the way through, and you really can't escape that.
Exactly, Tom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kate. Yeah.
And people, you know, we so easily want to put offenders as far away from us as possible. Let's send them to a correctional facility, and I don't want to look at them. But the truth is they are a part of our community. And every time we send someone away like that, we have torn the fabric of our community. We've pulled a thread out. Those people come back to the community, and that's part of what this is. What are we going to do when they come back? We can't continue to ignore them. We have to incorporate them in some way. And so if we can do a teen diversion program where they don't go to prison to begin with, and we have people in the community accepting responsibility for them, or if before someone is released, they can sit down with either the victim, or sometimes they have a surrogate for the victim, and they can fully comprehend the damage that they did. When they come back into the community, they can be fully integrated. And that's what the city of Tallahassee needs. That's what every community in the country needs.
Okay. And like mm-hmm. Agnes, in your case with Leonard, you're counting on him to keep up his end of the bargain through the contacts that he has within the prison. So as those folks get out, mm-hmm. they are the better for having known him.
Yes. Yes. Yes, that's the hope. And I don't have a foundation, but I have a group that we're calling Achieve Higher Ground. And the intent of that is to encourage the institution of a victim-offender dialogue program in the state of Florida. We have victim impact panels, but we don't have direct victim-offender dialogue in the state of Florida.
Now, I noticed that this is also committee week down at the Big White Building downtown. Mm-hmm. And let's just say that instead of being a radio studio here, we were in a committee hearing of some kind. Who knows? Maybe President Gates is, or Bashley's committee or something. You know, and mm-hmm. what message would you want to send to those folks and say, here's something you need to look at as you make these decisions?
Yeah, the victim offender dialogue programs work very well. And as I understand it, they are functioning in 33 different states in our country. It's not a unique concept. We don't have to invent the wheel. We can follow the guidelines that many other states are using on a regular basis. And it can provide healing for the victims and survivors, and provide healing for the offender as well. And as the offender heals, you know, we're hearing an awful lot these days about violence as a public health problem, that violence is contagious. And I believe that healing is contagious as well. And we can consciously try to spread that healing.
I can hear, however, some objections from some of the committee members right now. Well, number one, isn't that being soft on crime? And number two, how much is it going to cost?
Well, I think it's actually cheaper to keep someone out of prison than to send them to prison. And also, as for being soft on crime, I do believe that it's proven that longer prison sentences has really not decreased the crime level. And we've actually just created a prison culture. And, you know, these people are released. They can't vote. They can't find a place to live. It's a huge struggle. And you have the largest percentage of people incarcerated of any country in the world. It's like, what are we doing with those people once they're released? I mean, they become a burden to society because they can't find a job, they can't reincorporate themselves, or they end up back in prison again where it's just more expensive to keep them in prison.
And we imprison people, and then they're pulled from their families, and another set of families are shattered.
Right. And I would say, Tom, that, you know, like Agnes says, 33 other states have incorporated. But the real example is right here in Tallahassee of Agnes, Kate, and I. It's not like this is some faraway concept. It's right here in Tallahassee.
And is working. We have someone else who wants to pop in here and give some input to it. Bill's on line one. Hi, Bill. Thanks for calling. Welcome to Perspectives.
Thank you very much. Yes, I was listening to your program and thinking about the need for healing and restoring the humanity of people who have been victimized by crimes and violence. And I was thinking about HBCUs all over the state of Florida probably need to have programs like this, because there's so many African Americans in Florida that are suffering because of not having any kind of justice from all of the centuries of oppression, and needing to heal themselves and needing to move on with their lives. Well, and it would be, a powerful course, like a combination of community college or community university, where HBCUs provide that for African Americans community members.
And be a real outreach then into the community. That's what you're talking about, right, Bill?
Right, and where we have an opportunity to really explore what has happened to us as a people and how it is that we can make something positive of this experience. People are continually victimizing one another, particularly young black males, over and over again out of a sense of powerlessness that extends back, from back in those years and years of oppression and enslavement.
That's a wonderful idea, Bill, and that's something that I think everyone here at the table was – I saw the heads nodding, folks saying, boy, that would be a certainly a positive development in trying to connect academia certainly to the community and having that sense of responsibility, people, saying, okay, how does what I do impact other people? Both, close to me and even farther away.
Yeah, I would very definitely agree with Bill, and I'd also like to invite him to come on the 27th of this month at 7 o'clock at United Church on Mahan Drive. We're doing a presentation from the book. I'll be reading some of my material, and I have a young man who is going to be reading some of Leonard's material, and we'll talk about it.
What time is that going to be kicking off?
7 o'clock on Sunday evening.
Okay, at United Church on Mahan Drive, January 27th, and excerpts from Wildflowers in the Median. I love that title.
It's a line from one of the poems that I wrote.
So Kate, Andy, what's ahead for you folks now? As you, who knows? You might be on BBC before the day is out. You can't tell.
Well, we don't know. We're open to speaking to people. We've spoken before about our journey of forgiveness, and we're open to sharing with people the process of restorative justice.
We appreciate you all sharing with us today. Andy and Kate Romare and Agnes Fury, thank you for your stories and for speaking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM Tallahassee, Taylor Cox, Lydell Rawls, and Tom Flanagan along with you. Hoping you can join us again next week for more expert opinion and, of course, your input right here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.